Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, featuring a selection of international European cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, and more. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today we go back in time to the beginnings of the modern science of the brain, the mid-17th century. Our guest is award-winning science writer Carl Zimmer. His latest book is Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. In the book, Zimmer looks into the birth of neurology, a word coined by an English physician, Thomas Willis. Zimmer says Willis, in the 17th century, was demonstrating the brain, quote, could form memories, hatch imaginations, experience dreams. This at a time when people didn't think much of the brain. A philosopher of the day likened the brain to a cake of suet, a bowl of curds. Zimmer asks us to contrast that sentiment to brain science today. Today, he writes, when we look at the brain, we see an intricate network of billions of neurons in constant crackling communication, a chemical labyrinth that senses the world outside and within, produces love and sorrow, keeps our hearts beating and lungs breathing, composes our thoughts and constructs our consciousness. Still, Zimmer reminds us there is much we have yet to learn about the brain. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and observations for our guest, Carl Zimmer. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Carl Zimmer is a Guggenheim Fellow and the recipient of other prestigious honors for his reporting and writing. The author of three previous books, his work appears frequently in periodicals such as the New York Times, Newsweek, and Science. From 1994 to 1999, he was a senior editor at Discover. His latest book, Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World, is published by the Free Press. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Carl Zimmer, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. What set you on course to go back to the beginnings of brain science?
Well, I've always been fascinated by how the brain works and about scientific investigations of the brain. And I was just walking down the street one day, and it sort of occurred to me, I wonder how long it's been that people have thought of the brain the way we do, the way we make the brain the center of our existence. When we think about what is the definition of life, we really think of it in terms of the brain. For us, mm-hmm. brain death equals death. And so I started looking back through history to try to get a sense of when people started thinking that way, because it's not something that is actually immediately obvious. There's no kind of obvious reason to think that the brain plays such an incredibly central part in our lives.
Yeah. As the story opens in Soul Made Flesh, we're at Oxford in the year 1762, and we're in a room you describe as a cross between a laboratory and a butcher's shop. And among the men gathered in this room, Thomas Willis, who I mentioned in my introduction, Christopher Wren, who would become a famous architect, and a man by the name of Richard Lower. They'd come together at the request of Willis. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about these three men and what they were about to witness.
Well, these three men were part of the scientific revolution in the 1600s, and they had come together in Oxford after the English Civil War, where they were basically trying to sort of find a refuge from the kind of religious strife and such that was really dominating the country for so long. And they were there to sort of investigate science, and they were doing it in an entirely new way. They were giving up a lot of the old sort of worship of Aristotle and the other ancients, and were trying to sort of figure things out for themselves. And one of the things that they wanted to do was to understand the soul. And they realized that the only way to understand the soul is to understand the brain.
Hmm. That's a pretty radical idea at this time, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, as you said at the beginning, some people would say that the brain is no more capable of thought than a bowl of curds.
Mm.
That's the introduction I give for the book,
mm-hmm.
because that really, I mean, it's a very sensible kind of idea to have, because if you're doing an anatomy, an autopsy of a human cadaver, and it's the 1600s, and you don't have preservatives, and you don't have a refrigerator, when you start cutting open the cadaver, you can see the heart, and you can hold it in your hand and sort of see how the parts work, and you can look at the stomach and the liver and so on. The bones are obviously all there, but the brain is very quickly decaying, and really pretty much turns into kind of a watery substance. So how anyone would think that it could be capable of thought would just seem absurd to many people.
Mm. And I want to correct myself. It's Oxford 1662. I said 1762. It's the 17th century, but it's 1662. These men, Thomas Willis and Richard Lower, are, we would call them today scientists, although they really didn't fit that modern definition of a scientist. Maybe you would offer us some perspective now. How were they described in their day? How did they think of themselves?
They would have called themselves natural philosophers. The word scientist didn't really even exist then. It's, again, another strange thing for us to understand. Mm. But the whole practice of science, the way it's done today, simply hadn't come into existence yet. These people were helping to bring it into existence. But they believed that they were part of what was sort of almost kind of a religious mission. I mean, they believed that through what they called natural philosophy, they could see God's handiwork on Earth, whether they were looking at the human body or at the stars in the sky or at a chemical reaction taking place in a laboratory. That was all natural philosophy for them, and it was all the work of God. And so they also felt that natural philosophy needed to be turned upside down, basically, and that it had to be based more on experiments and on your own observation. So there were many sort of very detailed explanations for example, what the soul was and how we thought and so on, which had been around for centuries, and they basically rejected them and brought in lots of new concepts from all sorts of strange places, like physics, for example, or alchemy, and brought all of these ideas to bear on trying to figure out what the brain is and what the brain does.
Hmm. Did Willis have any idea that what he was doing would make such a contribution, would head us to where we are today?
Well, I don't think that Willis would have ever been able to imagine, for example, that scientists would be able to use these brain imaging machines, which can literally basically watch a brain in thought and pinpoint the areas that become active in the process. I don't think that he would have imagined that. And I also think that he wouldn't have imagined just how far people carried his basic ideas about how the brain the brain is us. While he believed that you could explain a lot about ourselves just through the material workings of the brain, he still believed that there were some things about human beings, like reason and so on, that couldn't be understood through science, and yet language and reason and so on, all these wonderful human attributes we have, we can see how they emerge from the brain as well.
Hmm. What did Willis, a man who was once on a path to become a member of the clergy, think or believe about the soul? And did his thinking about the soul change over time?
You can't really understand the the work of Willis without understanding his religion. I mean, when you talk about scientists today, you don't usually sort of start right off with their religion to talk about their research. But again, like I say, this was a different time. This was a time of natural philosophy. So Thomas Willis really invented the science of neurology as part of his religious mission. He, as you said, was destined for the clergy. He was a very pious young man. He went to Oxford University, and you know, basically most people on that path would then become priests in the Church of England. But the English Civil War intervened. He joined the army of the king and fought for him, and obviously ended up on the losing side. So joining the church was not going to be an option now that the Puritans were in charge, so he shifted to medicine. But he really sort of carried over his religious mission to medicine and to understanding people's souls, because for someone like Thomas Willis, seeing, for example, the Archbishop of Canterbury being decapitated, as he was, executed, just seemed like sort of a nationwide madness.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to figure out how to cure insanity and literally to save the souls of his fellow Englishmen. And that sort of led him through kind of long and indirect ways to recognizing the brain for what it is.
Mm. Tell us more about his day. You said that he's survived now war and plague, of course. What was the world of Thomas Willis like?
Well, it was a tough world to live in, just on a very basic level. You're dealing with incredible outbreaks of disease, all sorts of diseases. You know, people are you know, just watching half of their children dying just as a regular course. Also very violent, obviously. Lots of, not only was there an English Civil War, but then there were lots of outbreaks afterwards. And also a world that's still steeped in sort of what we might call superstition. I wouldn't use that kind of label for it, but ideas about how the world works are just very different from our own. So, for example, if you were to have a dream that you were in some other place, someone might accuse you of being a witch who was actually being transported to that other place in your sleep. If you had an epileptic seizure, someone might say you were actually being seized by a demon and shaken around. These sorts of ideas are incredibly common, and it's sort of a testament to Thomas Willis that he would look at these sorts of ideas and just dismiss them and instead introduce basically, you know, these sort of ideas that we have now about the mind and the soul.
He had to have been a sharp observer. I know that you write about his interest in the things people ate and drank and how that affected them.
Yeah, Thomas Willis really just watched everything and just seemed to sort of store it all in his head somehow. He just was a remarkable observer. Even as setting aside the brain for a minute, I mean, he, as a doctor, he wrote down details about diseases which are the first clinical observations that we've ever had of things like, for example, influenza or of typhus. He's the first one. And he also was very observant of neurological or psychological disorders. So again, when you want to find, for example, the first description of narcolepsy, where people just fall asleep suddenly, you go to Thomas Willis. And if you want to go find the first description of of a bipolar disorder. You go to Thomas Willis. He may not have known exactly what was happening in all these cases, or in any of these cases, really, but his observations were so great that you can recognize what they are when you're looking back at them. And then it was from these observations, these observations really helped sort of form the backbone of his new theory about the mind.
Hmm. His research, his observation, his writings, how much of his papers survive?
Well, not as much as I would like. I mean, I find Thomas Willis to be an incredibly fascinating and completely overlooked figure in the history of science. We have about half dozen books that he wrote, and we have just a few letters. We have a notebook that he kept as a very young doctor. It's just a wonderful little leather notebook you could just slip in your pocket, and it's filled with tiny little notes written in Latin. And aside from that, there's nothing. I mean, a lot of his letters were lost and so on. So there are, he in some ways, he remains a very enigmatic figure. But there's enough out there that you can start to understand how it is that he made this incredible breakthrough.
Yeah. In your note on sources, you say the people whom I describe in this book do not yet add up, but they sure are intriguing. What were the, maybe you talk, well, it's a little bit of a side trip here, but the challenges and rewards for you of doing this research?
Oh, this was really quite a lot of fun. I would say that most of my work is writing about current science or relatively recent science. So I'll write something in a science magazine, say, about the latest ideas about the origin of life, for example. But I find it really helpful to kind of step back and sort of see where all of these ideas and lines of research come from. I mean, someone didn't just wake up yesterday and say, hey, I have all these great ideas, and this is what I'm going to do as a scientist. I mean, what the science that we see around us today has a very old heritage. And so it's really a lot of fun to kind of go back and see these things, these ideas that we just take for granted, coming into existence for the first time and trying to figure out how that all happened. And you also get to do fun things like go to the library at Oxford University, this wonderful medieval building, and go in there and actually be able to look at the first editions of these books from the 1600s, with the original illustrations by Christopher Wren right there in front of you. It's a grand experience, and I really enjoyed it.
Mm. Writer and reporter Carl Zimmer is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to ask, well, first I have an anecdote, which is about the ancient Greeks, which maybe you looked into because 17th century people were preoccupied, but they thought that you thought with your heart and your head was a radiator for dissipating heat. And often in the wintertime when I see college students wandering around with no hat on, and since there is so much blood flow to the head, that it is sort of a radiator, and that's maybe all what they're using it for at the time. But that's just a little quip of mine. I'm wondering how they got to it. Was he an anatomist? Was he looking at the connections of nerves? And I also know that I was thinking that the preoccupation with electricity or the first I'm trying to remember the guy that was playing with frog legs and electricity and was making them move, and was the interconnectedness of the nerves, and is that how they got to the idea that the brain was, or was it more intuitive, or can you unpack that a little bit, and I will hang up and get back to what I was doing. Listen, thanks.
Well, those are a bunch of great questions. Let me take on the first one about the ancient Greeks. It's true that many of them, such as Aristotle, believed that the heart was basically what we would call the mind, that it the heart perceived the senses and that the heart created our actions and so on. This idea actually carried over into European thought, so that the heart was believed to have a soul of its own called the vital soul that was responsible for these things. And the head, when you talk to Aristotle about the brain, he was again working on the assumption that the brain was just this watery substance. Some people would call it just phlegm. And he thought, well, it seems very cold, and so therefore it must be basically a refrigerator, because you need something to cool down the heat from the heart. And so we humans have a big brain, not because the brain is where our intelligence lies, but because we're very warm, and therefore we need a big refrigerator. The other question he had was sort of how this, what Willis was doing to sort of make this breakthrough. Electricity didn't have anything to do with it. You have to remember that it was over a century before people would realize that electricity is carried along through the nervous system. People still believed that there were these things that they would call spirits that would basically course through the nerves. Thomas Willis sort of made the breakthrough of thinking of spirits not as a sort of spiritual, mystical thing, but just as chemicals, as atoms of some sort moving around and somehow carrying information. So he's sort of reconceived the nervous system as this chemical thing. And the question of how Thomas Willis did all this, well, I mean, it's a pretty complicated story, and I talk about it in the book at great length. But a couple of the key things are he was a great anatomist, but he was also a lot of other things. So, as I said, he was a great medical observer. So he had all this information in his head about people with hysteria or epilepsy or madness, and could see patterns and how the mind became sick. He was also an alchemist. So he was thinking about the brain and the nervous system in terms of chemistry, and he was also doing experiments, sometimes rather grisly experiments, on animals to test out some of his ideas. So you take all of that stuff and sort of put it all together, that sort of was that right combination of things that created this insight about the brain.
Mm. In his day, was dissection of human corpses, were autopsies performed in an effort to determine causes of death?
They were just starting to, and Thomas Willis was one of the first people to really do that in earnest. Europeans had been dissecting humans for centuries. There was a very long tradition of anatomy in Europe, but really it was a part of this whole natural philosophy I was talking about. In other words, someone would, during one of these dissections, which was usually of a criminal who had just been executed, someone would cut open the cadaver, and the anatomist would be actually sitting up on a raised chair with a book in his hand, a book written by an ancient Greek doctor, and then would read the book to explain what was being shown in the cadaver. He wouldn't actually get down and look for himself. He didn't need to, it was felt, and because everything was already known. And so you just cut open the cadaver to sort of show how the human body was beautifully constructed to house these different souls that I mentioned before. So what happens in Thomas Willis's day is that that the anatomists get down from their chair and start looking at the cadaver for themselves, and start seeing that the Greeks didn't get everything right, they got a lot of things wrong, and that the body works in a very different way than how they thought. And so they were still dissecting executed criminals, but people like Thomas Willis were doing something else as well, when one of his patients died, he would often ask the family if he could do an autopsy because he wanted to go in and see what was wrong. Mm-hmm. And he was particularly interested in trying to figure out when people were having convulsions or were raving or had some sort of strange, what we call neurological or psychological disorder. He wanted to cut open their heads and see what was going on inside there. Was there any damage to the brain that he could link to these diseases? And so, you know, he was the first person to start doing that.
Let's talk with some more listeners. First, we go to a caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
Yeah, it's you.
I just wanted to say that as a modern legacy of him is his description of the circle of Willis, the base of the brain with a circle of arteries around the optic nerve. And this has been an extraordinarily important anatomic touchstone for surgery procedures today and in teaching of students and so on. I'll hang up.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Yeah, that it's funny that the circle of Willis, this little structure of blood vessels, is really the only thing that a lot of people, even doctors, even neurologists, know about Thomas Willis. So many of them don't know, for example, that he wrote the first book ever written solely on the brain and the nervous system. They don't know that he's the person who invented the word neurology. They don't know that he basically saw that it was the brain and not the heart or some other thing that was responsible for thought. It's a peculiar little twist of history that really all he's remembered for is this circle of vessels. It was a brilliant bit of detective work that he did to figure out how these vessels work, and they helped sort of lead him onto these greater realizations, though.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. And I certainly don't mean to discount the importance of the brain in any way, but I find it interesting that as more and more scientific discoveries and advancements are made, some of these earlier notions about the distribution of our ability to think being distributed throughout various parts of the body and not just the central nervous system seem to be coming back around now. For instance, you talked about the chemical basis for the operation of the brain, and now we're discovering that the glial cells, not the neurons, actually are extremely important in our ability to think and process, and that in many ways you could think of the brain as a huge chemical factory that's producing all kinds of molecules. But we've also discovered that these same molecules are being produced and consumed throughout the entire body. Probably the most, the biggest example of that would be serotonin, which most people realize is an important chemical messenger in the central nervous system. Actually, there's more of it produced in the intestines and used there than in the central nervous system, and that's just one of many, many examples. And I'm wondering, what your thoughts on that is.
Yeah, there certainly are a lot of insights that are emerging these days that show that the nervous system in particular, and the way the whole body sort of is, where in processes information is a lot more complicated than Thomas Willis realized. And for example, your stomach has a whole kind of web of neurons that can act a bit sort of autonomously on their own. So people have kind of talked about this gut brain, as it were. I don't think, though, that it sort of takes away from the central importance of the brain. And it's a little, you have to be careful not to sort of be comparing apples and oranges, in the sense that what I'm talking about is comparing what Thomas Willis realized with what came before. So, for example, people imagined that there were three holes in your head, and that as when you breathed in air, the air was transformed either coming straight into your nose or through your lungs into what were called animal spirits that swirled through these giant holes in your head and then were pumped down into your body to produce your movements and so on. And, you know, those holes just don't exist. I mean, this was sort of the central kind of part of, if you could call it, medieval psychology for hundreds and hundreds of years, based on something that simply does not exist. And it was Thomas Willis who, through some elegant experiments, said these holes, what we call ventricles, just aren't important here. And we have to look at the brain itself. So, science has certainly moved on from what Thomas Willis discovered, but that doesn't take away from his accomplishments.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else you're listening, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Carl Zimmer, author of Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. Would Thomas Willis and Descartes have been familiar with one another's work?
excuse me. Thomas Willis was in the generation of natural philosophers that came after Descartes.
Okay.
So Descartes died just around the time that Thomas Willis was really starting his medical career. So while Descartes didn't know about Willis, Willis, along with everybody else, knew about Descartes because Descartes had really just sort of put science in general and sort of human biology in particular just on a totally new footing, because he said, you know, I'm going to try to describe the body not as this thing governed by this soul in your heart or maybe a soul in your liver, not as something that's being controlled by the four humors, but as a collection of particles, what we would call atoms or molecules, being pushed around by different mechanical forces. So he's thinking about the body as a machine for the first time. And that includes a lot of what the brain does. So he would talk about, for example, the way you pull your foot out from a fire. He would say, well, you don't need a soul to do that. It's just sort of a mechanical arrangement that the force of the little fire particles on your foot set into motion this process where basically he thought, imagine that they would kind of tug on your nerves and that this would send spirits rushing down to your foot and make your foot pull away. So you don't need a soul in that process to say, oh, my foot is hot, I need to move my foot away. So he takes the whole understanding of the mind and the body to a totally new level. The problem is that he's still wedded to these basically medieval ideas, for example, of the ventricles, these chambers that I mentioned. He comes up with very elaborate explanations for how particles swirl through these ventricles and how that can do things like, for example, make you pull your foot away from a fire. So if it was just for Descartes, we would have no science of neurology. We would not understand the brain as the brain works. We needed people to sort of take the next step beyond that, and Thomas Willis was really the most important person in that big step.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Go ahead.
I just have a question in the hopes that maybe your guest will expand a little on his discussion of the circle of Willis, which I really hadn't even connected to the topic of this conversation, but I have read in a couple of instances that a number of aneurysms are often located in the circle of Willis, and this obviously is a little side issue, but I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about it if your guest would be willing to discuss it. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Sure. I don't know for certain about whether aneurysms are associated in particular with the circle of Willis. I wouldn't be surprised because it's this very intricate network of vessels that it's sort of like this a matrix almost. And for Thomas Willis, it was important for a couple reasons. I mean, the thing is that if you were to have one of your carotid arteries cut off somehow, your brain would still be completely supplied with blood. You wouldn't lose the blood on that side of your brain because the blood could go up through your carotid artery on the other side and then travel around the circular villus and then go into the blood vessels on the other side of the brain as well. So Willis proved this by doing surgery on a dog and cutting off one of the arteries and then sewing up the dog again and seeing what happened. And lo and behold, the dog was perfectly happy and would follow Thomas Willis around on his medical appointments. And Thomas Willis was delighted. And it showed to him that the brain was it confirmed to him that this brain was a beautifully sort of constructed machine, like a fine watch with his beautiful little sort of safety factors built into it. And the key was that the blood was being supplied to the brain itself, that this blood was not going into these so-called ventricles, these holes in your head, where they would supply spirits. They would go all the way around the brain, and he would do these beautiful experiments where he would inject dye into the vessels and see where they went, and they would see how, because you could follow the dye. And he described the brain that he did this to as looking like a curious quilted ball. He was so struck by how completely covered the brain was with these fine blood vessels, and that really drove home to him that it's the brain itself, it's the flesh of this brain where thought is taking place.
Hmm. Before Willis, there was an Italian, this would have been in the 1500s, Andreas Vesalius, and I want to get back to the idea of soul-made flesh here. He suspected the brain might be a place to look for the powers of the soul, but you say he didn't push the idea. He was reluctant to continue on that thread. Talk with us about why that was the case, and then was that also a problem for Willis and his circle?
Well, Vesalius is working a little over a century before Thomas Willis. He's a Flemish-born anatomist who's working in Italy. And I had mentioned before about how it used to be that anatomists would sit in their chair and read out from a book while someone else would cut open a cadaver. Well, Vesalius was really the first person to get down out of that chair and look for himself. And he then went on to publish a spectacular atlas of human anatomy that became just a complete landmark in our understanding of the whole human body. And he studied the brain. He did as good a job as he could do with the equipment he had and the methods he had. But, you know, it's when you think about it, it must have been kind of a mess, because literally what he would do for most of his drawings, he would he would take a head, and then he would saw off the top layer of skull and look down at the brain, at that part of the brain, and drew what he saw. And then he would sort of slice off another layer and then look down at what he saw, and so on and so on and so on, down all the way through the brain. As you can imagine, this made a pretty bloody mess of things. Still, he did a really good job of figuring out the anatomy of the brain. And he did notice that these ventricles, which were supposed to be these three beautifully vaulted spherical holes in the head, just weren't there. I mean, there were some little gaps in the brain, but nothing like what was supposed to be there. And he made a note of this. And he said, and he basically what he was saying was, maybe we should be looking elsewhere to understand what these spirits are doing. But he did not push the issue any further, and he literally said that he wanted to avoid being accused of being a heretic. Because, as strange as it is for us now to think, human anatomy was very much part of church dogma. You know, the church had an explanation for how the human body was put together, and that fit in beautifully with their explanation of the immortal soul and so on. I mean, it all fit together very well, and if you questioned it, you were questioning the church.
Yeah.
Thomas Willis is working a century later, over a century later. The scientific revolution is much further along. He's working in Protestant England, which is a little less sort of centrally controlled than you know, Catholic Italy. And so things are a bit different. But he still knows that he's got to be very careful with how he describes all of this stuff, because basically he's saying that a lot of what the soul does is actually carried out by just flesh and blood, by matter in motion. And so what's interesting to see is it's interesting to look at the dedications that Thomas Willis puts on the three books that he wrote about the brain and the soul. All three of the books are dedicated to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he basically asks for the Archbishop's protection from those who would accuse him of being an atheist. And he goes on to sort of to describe how he really believes that what he's doing is going to be a service to the church and to Christianity. But he's very you can feel the anxiety coming off the page that someone's going to take him for an atheist.
Mm. Today, as I mentioned in my introduction almost an hour ago, you note in the book that today there's still so much that we don't know. It's as if we're still in that dissection room with Thomas Willis in the 1660s. Or maybe, I suppose, you could also liken us to being in that chair high above the corpse. What are some of the... Maybe you could talk with us a little bit here at the end about some of the most profound mysteries that remain in brain science today.
There are a lot. I mean, brain science is an amazing thing right now because, I mean, if you go to the Society for Neurosciences annual meeting, they have about 25,000 or 30,000 people come each year. And there are over 10,000 presentations of research every year. So, you know, there are so many questions from, you know, how is it that all these neurotransmitters that we're learning about now, how is it that they produce our emotional states? Or how is it that they help us learn? What is memory? We don't really know more than just a few clues about what memory is. And the biggest thing would be, I'd say, consciousness. I mean, it's the simplest thing about your existence. I mean, you know you're conscious, and it's quite obvious when someone is unconscious. And yet, no scientist can give you a really good account of what consciousness is. And it may be that despite all of the fantastic technology that they have at their disposal right now, consciousness may be just too complex for our current technology to give us an answer, or maybe our ideas are just too simple at this point. But at any rate, though, scientists are actually beginning to do actual real science on scientific studies on consciousness. So there's a start there, but it's going to be a long time before it's finished.
Yeah. Before we have to say farewell this afternoon, maybe you would tell us a little something about Joshua Green.
Well, at the end of the book, I wanted to kind of bring us up to date because I spent a lot of time in the 1600s talking about this revolution, and I want to give a sense of what that revolution has wrought. I mean, how we've ended up where we are now thanks to people like Thomas Willis. And Joshua Green is a very young researcher at Princeton. He started out as a philosopher, and now he's a neuroscientist as well, and he's basically trying to figure out how we make moral judgments, how we decide what's right and wrong, by looking at our brains and scanning people as they are making these difficult moral choices. And he is actually, you know, literally sort of dissecting these circuits that we use that have evolved in our brains to make us decide that something is good or bad, something is right or wrong, something is evil or just. He I think, really kind of embodies the incredible achievements that are now being built on Thomas Willis's work.
Fascinating. Carl Zimmer, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Carl Zimmer has been our guest. His latest book is Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. It is a very good read. The book is published by the Free Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures prices finished like this. In the wheat pit, July contract was up 3.5 cents. It had a high today of 382, a low of 377. One half and a settlement price at 381.5. Most of the wheat chugging just a bit higher today, erasing some of yesterday's losses. September wheat 391, high, low at 386. A settlement price there at 390.5, and they were up 6.5 for the day. In December contract, 402, the high, the low at 396. Settled 401, up 5.5 cents for the day. March contract, 408.5, high, low at 402. Settlement price at 407.5, they were up 6. And the May futures in the wheat pit, 410, the high, the low at 406, settled 408, up 4 for the day. July corn futures now 305, the high, the low at $3 even, settled just above that at $3.75 in the nearby July, down 3 cents. September futures, $3.5, the high, the low at 296, the settlement price at 296 and a quarter, down 3. Your new crop December, 298, the high, the low at 292.5, a settlement price at 293.5, down 3. Wire reports say Chicago was very thinly traded today. Traders not quite sure what to make of the weather as we go into the holiday weekend over Memorial Day. Of course, the markets are closed on Monday, and they're still not sure what happened in Iowa and parts of Minnesota, and how much replanting will need to be taking place there, and whether that, what they're thinking in terms of about 1 million acres, will go into beans or corn. So it's a wait-and-see game in Chicago. The March contract, 302 and a quarter high for the day, low at 297 and a quarter, settlement price at 298, and they were down 2.75. And the May futures at 304 and three quarters high, low at 301 and a quarter, settlement price there at 301 and three quarters, down 2.75. Speaking of wait-and-see, we'll see exactly what Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services has to say about the marketplace at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon, Central Time, during the closing market report. Now the May contract in the corn pit, 204 and three quarters high, low at 301 and a quarter, settled 301 and three quarters, down 2.75. July futures, 304.5 high, low at 301, settled on that low, down 2.5 cents. September corn, 284 high, low at 282, settled on the low, down 2 cents. And December futures, 273.5 the high, the low and the settlement price both at 271, they were down 2 for the day. July oats, 154 the high, the low at 152, settled 153.25, up a half. And September futures, 159 and three quarters high, low at 157 and three quarters, settlement price at 159.25. And they finished up 1.75 for the day. Soy complex now, bean futures off a dime in the nearby contract. 894 the high, the low at 865, a settlement price at 872. They're off 10.25 to be exact for that July bean contract. August futures, 844 high, low at 820, settled 823.5, 6.5 cents lower. And September futures, 758 the high, the low at 745, settled 749, 1.5 cents lower. November contract now, 716 the high for the day, low at 701, a 15-cent trading range, settled at 709, down 1.25 in the November beans. January futures, 716 high, low at 704, settled 710.5, a half-cent lower. And the March futures, 712 the high, low at 701, settled 709.25, up 0.25 cents. May futures in the bean pit, 705 the high, the low at 698, settled 703.5, and they were unchanged on the day. July bean meal now, 289 the high, the low at 276.70, settled 277.30. They were down 970 on the day. The August meal at 276 high, low at 265, settled 266.50. They were off 650. July bean oil, 29.15 high, low at 28.68, settled 28.86, up 12. And the August futures, 28.63 for the high, the low at 28.18. August bean oil settled 28.24, up 3 for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Cattle were higher today. Lean hogs finished lower. May feeder cattle, the high price today, 106.10, the low 105.90, the settlement 106.10, that up 40. August 105.02.5, the high 103.70, the low 104.45, the settlement, that up 10. September feeder cattle, 103.50, the high, 102.55, the low, the settlement, 103.30, that up 5. June live cattle, 82.75, the high, 81.80, the low, 82.67.5, the settlement, that up 35. August live cattle, 85.75, the high, 84.75, the low, 85.67.5, the settlement, that up 22.5. June lean hogs, 74.65, the high, 74 even the low, the settlement, 74.27.5, that down 65. July lean hogs, 73.30, the high, 72.45, the low, the settlement, 72.72.5, down 87.5. August lean hogs, 72 even the high, 71.02.5, the low, the settlement, 71.70, that down 80 cents. October lean hogs, 60.95, the high, 59.97.5 the low, 60.75 the settlement, that down 70. And July pork bellies, 114.15 today's high, 112.90 the low, 113.72.5 the settlement, that up 55. The Dow is up 5 points at 10,123. The Nasdaq 11 higher at 1975, and the S&P 500 is up 3 points at 1116.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
A virtual poser from Juliet Kaufman, Rochester, New York. Dear Dr. Science, if you could hear the internet, what would it sound like?
Have you ever heard a cat fight taking place in an echoey garage? Now imagine someone babbling incoherently in the corner, and another person, say an old woman, sobbing outside, banging on the door, pleading with her cat to stop fighting. Multiply that sound times a few million, and you've got the hidden sonic ambience of the internet. Fortunately, our computers carry sophisticated filters which reduce the horrendous cacophony to a simple, irritating squawk. The new high-end powered subwoofer systems give you that squawk in amazing fidelity.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD, screensaver for PCs, and a master's degree mouse pad, $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock, 68 degrees in Urbana. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. You'll find us online at